All right, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and we're in the urinary chapter. We're going to finish that up today. Well, we have no choice, but it will end today. Okay? I don't know if we'll finish it or not, but we'll get through some of the more important things in that chapter. And don't forget, since this is the last lecture, you do have a final exam coming up, and that's going to be, I believe, 1 week from today, December 15th. And it's going to be in this room, but it's going to be a little bit earlier than 11:30. It's scheduled for 10:30. 10:30 to 12:30. And it's just a regular test. It's not cumulative. So if you get done in an hour, I suppose you could be here at 11:30 and finish on time. Right? So just however long it's taken you on the previous test. So it'll probably be about 100 questions, something like that. Exam figures are important, just like all the other tests. All right, any questions on the exam? 10:30. Yeah, 10:30. So the final schedule changes a little bit, but it's still in the morning right here. All right, a week from today. Sign-in sheet will be going around right here, so please go ahead and sign the sign-in sheet and then pass it down to the front. All right, so what's the structural and functional unit of urine formation? It is? I heard in the front here, but you guys in the back have to speak up a little bit. Like you in the back row. Somebody in the back row, tell me. What's the structural and functional unit of urine formation? Yeah, it's a nephron. Okay, so you should have a list of structural and functional units of things that do things in your body by the time you leave this class and know all the little pieces. And so we're going to look at the nephron today and see how it produces urine. And I don't believe that we draw the nephron out on the board last time?
Yeah.
Ah, okay, good. So I don't really want to do that. What about the functions? Did I write the three functions down?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay, what are the three functions? We have the first one is tubular filtration. No, not tubular filtration. It's called glomerular filtration or just filtration. That's the movement of plasma that's in the blood into Bowman's capsule right here. That's the first process. All right, the second process, as that filtrate moves through these tubules right here, things can be removed from the filtrate and put back in the blood, like things that your body needs. Give me an example of a molecule that's small enough to be filtered, but good enough to where your body doesn't want it to be excreted. Like some electrolytes, sodium, potassium, and water as well. We're going to take a look at water. We call that tubular reabsorption. That's the second process. Right? So if it gets resorbed, it goes from filtrate back into the blood. But if it stayed in the filtrate, where would it end up? In the collecting duct, and then it would become urine and excreted from the body. So those precious substances are resorbed, as well as glucose. Is glucose important in your body? Yeah, that's a small enough molecule to be filtered, but usually if we have a normal body, 100% of glucose that's filtered into the filtrate is resorbed. We'll look at that process. And then the third process, not all harmful compounds that are in blood get filtered into Bowman's capsule, right? So they continue to be in the peritubular capillaries, and the kidney can excrete them. What process can excrete harmful compounds that are in the peritubular capillaries, right? How can they be excreted in the urine? What's the process that puts them in urine? Tubular secretion. So tubular secretion goes from blood to filtrate, and if it's in the filtrate, eventually it's going to end up in the collecting duct and then placed in the urine. All right, so those are the three processes that I want you to be aware of. The other thing I want you to get a bit of a feel for is that there are two kinds of nephrons in the kidney. There are some that are mostly in the cortex, and of course here's the line of demarcation between the cortex and the medulla. And can anybody name these blood vessels right here that arch over the base of the renal pyramids? Oh, you're going to have to flip back previous semester. What the heck did we call these? These are the arcuate vein and arteries. So that's the separation between the cortex and the medulla. Maybe go back and look at your anatomy book. Well, so here, these are what we call cortical nephrons. These over here were the renal corpuscle is in the cortex, but look at that loop of Henle. It dives very deep down into the medulla. It's a lot longer. These are what we call the juxtamedullary nephrons. And I do want you to know at least what the function is, right? So you see that these two nephrons are located in different places in the kidney. They have different shapes, so what might your guess be in terms of function? They're going to be different as well, right? So these juxtamedullary nephrons are very special because they can concentrate urine. So when you are low on fluids, they can produce very small amounts of very concentrated urine, so you can excrete a lot of salts in the urine. Okay, and the cortical nephrons pretty much work all the time for producing large amounts, copious amounts of watery urine. All right, so that's the main difference. But we're not going to have time to really look at why that is. You should at least know that they're there. All right, so that first segment of a convoluted tubule, we call the proximal convoluted tubule. The wall consists of just a single layer of cuboidal cells, but those cuboidal cells are covered with microvilli on the apical surface, and that increases the surface area. And when we say increased surface area, what's the everyday word that you should be thinking of?
A doorway
for transport, for reabsorption of materials that are in the filtrate. So tubular reabsorption, which way do materials go for tubular reabsorption? Filtrate to blood or blood to filtrate? Filtrate the blood. Maybe you should have that diagram that we wrote on the board right in front of you so that you can see those little arrows right there. All right. So during reabsorption, salt, water, and other molecules needed by the body are transported, all right, from the lumen of a kidney tubule, like what? The proximal convoluted tubule, through the tubular cells and into the surrounding peritubular capillaries. So that's tubular reabsorption. Okay. All right, let's talk about that first process, filtration, glomerular filtration. The glomerular capillaries, okay, are found in Bowman's capsule, and they filter blood. And these capillaries are special. Remember, there's three kinds of capillaries based on their permeability. The continuous is not very permeable. Fenestrated are very permeable, and then the sinusoids are extremely leaky. So these fenestrated capillaries have large pores in them to allow small molecules to pass right from the plasma into Bowman's capsule. Okay, so if we just look at some of the anatomy, here we see Bowman's capsule. So this would be the parietal division of Bowman's capsule, and it's continuous. The cells are basically kind of the same, right, that line the glomerular capillary. So this would be the visceral division of Bowman's capsule that's touching the glomerular capillaries, and you can see that there are big filtration slits, right, between these processes that come from the cells of the visceral Bowman's capsule, which we call podocytes. Right. And the endothelium of the capillary also has pores in them, right, which we call fenestrations, so small molecules can move from the blood into Bowman's capsule very efficiently, depending on maybe the blood pressure that's in this particular capillary right here and how much blood is flowing through the capillary. All right, so all small molecules can leave. All right, so important molecules like glucose leave, and harmful molecules like urea leave. Well, if urea enters the filtrate, that's a good thing because you want it excreted. But other molecules like glucose, you don't want to lose in the urine. That's an important energy molecule. I'm sure you are aware of that. There are also plasma proteins that are way too big to fit through the fenestrations. The other thing is that those plasma proteins have a negative charge on them, and the lining of the glomerulus also has a negative charge. So what can you tell me about those two negative charges? They repel each other. So that also helps inhibit the loss of proteins into the urine. Some albumin enters the filtrate, but that is resorbed in the proximal convoluted tubule. All right, but if there is damage to the filtration membrane, if there's damage to the glomerulus or those podocytes, maybe due to infection or other kinds of processes, right, and those slit diaphragms become too big, they start to leak. large proteins into the filtrate, and that can find its way into the urine, and we call that proteinuria. And we call that just spilling protein into the urine, and that's a sign of damage to the renal corpuscle when that happens. Right? And so sometimes we call that nephritis as well. And there should never be blood in the urine, because how big is a red blood cell compared to those fenestrations? Right, a red blood cell is huge. It's almost the diameter of a capillary. So red blood cells shouldn't leak out, but if they do, what? That just means that there's terrible holes in the glomerulus. So, and that's a sign of infection or nephritis as well. All right, so name the process by which small plasma solutes enter the glomerular filtrate through those fenestrations and between the foot processes. What do we call that? That is glomerular filtration. That's the first process, right? Okay. So the glomerular filtration rate is going to be related to the amount of blood that's flowing through the glomerulus. Right, the volume of filtrate produced by both kidneys averages about 115 milliliters per minute. That's a huge amount of fluid. Who's got a liter container? Does anybody have a liter bottle? How about a half liter bottle? Oh, there's a liter bottle. So, right, about 115 of those pass through, are filtered every minute in your body. That's a huge amount of water. Right, so that totals about 180 liters. Per day. That's 45 gallons. And what would happen if you were to lose, you know, 115 milliliters per minute or 45 gallons a day of fluid from your body? What would happen? Well, yeah, you would die. You'd dehydrate. Well, what would be one of the first things? As soon as you lose this volume from your blood, what's going to happen to your blood pressure? It's going to drop, right? And you won't be able to perfuse any tissues. So, most of the filtered water must be resorbed, all right, through the rest of the tubular system, or death would ensue rather rapidly. All right, and if, when that happens, we just call that kidney failure. So that glomerular filtration rate is controlled both by a number of different mechanisms, all right, so that you don't lose too much fluid. There are both extrinsic and intrinsic mechanisms. What does extrinsic mean? It comes from outside the organ. Intrinsic means that it has to do with just a property of the organ all by itself. Doesn't need innervation or hormones to regulate it. All right, so vasoconstriction or vasodilation of the afferent arteriole affects how much blood flows into the glomerulus, right? Just because of what law would you invoke to explain how blood flow through the glomerulus is regulated by vasoconstriction or vasodilation? Yes, I maybe heard it, It's a French guy, but not Le Chatelier. It is Poiseuille's law, right? So when there's vasoconstriction, blood flow goes down by what? The radius by the fourth factor. So that's a very efficient way of regulating blood flow and thus glomerular filtration in the kidney. All right, so let's talk about extrinsic first and the autonomic nervous system. And we're going to look at a response loop. What does a response loop always start with? Stimulus. So we got a couple of different stimuli right here. Decrease in blood pressure. And there are things in your body that can sense blood pressure, namely the baroreceptors are the sensors, and they're going to send information to the vasomotor center. All right. And what's the vasomotor center? Where is the vasomotor center? In the medulla. And there's a set point in the medulla, and the medulla can make a decision on what to do. So when blood pressure decreases, the medulla decides to increase sympathetic nerve activity. And what's that effect on the body? What's the effect on the heart of increased sympathetic tone? Increased heart rate, increased force of contraction, right? Both it's a positive inotropic and chronotropic effect. What's going to happen to cardiac output if heart rate goes up? And if stroke volume goes up? It's going to increase, right? So we increase cardiac output. Sympathetic nerve activity, or an increase, right, is also going to cause vasoconstriction of the afferent arterioles in the kidneys. So the kidneys are innervated by the sympathetic nervous system. And when these afferent arterioles vasoconstrict, guess what happens to glomerular filtration? You need to have blood going through the glomerulus in order for it to be filtered. So if blood isn't going through the glomerulus, the filtration rate decreases. And that's going to decrease urine production. That's going to have a tendency to preserve fluids in your body or increase blood volume. And as you increase blood volume, you have more blood returning to the heart during diastole. It will fill more and stretch. And what's going to happen? As blood volume increases, the heart fills more and diastolic volume increases, what's going to happen? Yeah, that's going to, right, make the heart stronger because of the Frank Starling law. It's going to contract with more force, right? Cardiac output is going to go up, and that's going to subtract from the initial stimulus was a decrease in blood pressure. So an increase in cardiac output or an increase in blood volume increase blood pressure, right? So that's a nice negative feedback loop. All right, the sympathetic nerve activity is also going to cause vasoconstriction in the skin and the GI tract. That's going to increase total peripheral resistance. And how is total peripheral resistance related to blood pressure? If resistance goes up, what happens to blood pressure? It increases as well. We did that little algebraic manipulation on the board, right? That's not so intuitive, but if you need to look at your notes on how resistance affects blood pressure, go back and take a look at those. All right, so again, that subtracts from the stimulus, so that's a very important negative feedback mechanism too. The only other stimulus we didn't talk about is that exercise has a tendency to increase sympathetic tone for a short while in a person's body, and that will have a tendency to increase blood pressure. All right, and then after exercise, your body compensates and you probably have even lower blood pressure after exercise, after you recover. One little exception to that, weightlifters can train themselves to be hypertensive. And if you're concerned about that, maybe you should talk to me after class. All right, so that is extrinsic due to the autonomic nervous system, in particular the sympathetic autonomic nervous system. All right, so let's talk about the intrinsic mechanisms. All right, this is defined as the abilities to maintain relatively constant glomerular filtration even when blood pressure is going up or going down. So the kidneys are going to continue to do their job and compensate for changes in blood pressure. And the two kinds of intrinsic mechanisms we call the myogenic response, and the other is the tubuloglomerular response. Right, the myogenic constriction of afferent arterioles, what happens to blood flow through the glomerulus if this afferent arteriole constricts? Okay, the flow decreases, glomerular filtration will then decrease as a result of that. All right, so myogenic constriction of the afferent arteriole is due to smooth muscle responding to an increase in arterial pressure. So as the blood pressure increases, the arterioles are going to constrict, and that's going to maintain pretty much a constant blood flow through the glomerulus as a result. All right, the second one, tubuloglomerular, is achieved through local effects produced by chemicals right in the juxtaglomerular apparatus. And so I'm going to show you a picture of that pretty soon. All right, so here are some mechanisms for extrinsic and intrinsic regulation of glomerular filtration. All right, in this first case, sympathetic activity is going to constrict the afferent arteriole. That's going to decrease glomerular filtration. All right, autoregulation, for instance, if there's a decrease in blood pressure, the afferent arteriole is going to dilate, right? So if there's a decrease in blood pressure, what is going to happen to, if nothing else changes, what's going to happen to blood flow through the glomerulus if blood pressure decreases? It's going to decrease, right? So the way the kidney compensates for that decrease in blood flow through the glomerulus is that it just automatically dilates the arterioles, and that restores flow through the glomerulus. So that's going to, right, even though blood pressure is changing, that's going to produce no change in glomerular filtration rate. Right? So that's going to maintain the function of the kidneys. Right? And the opposite is true as well. If there is an increase in blood pressure, right, that would increase glomerular filtration, right? But your kidneys want to maintain a constant function. So when blood pressure increases, the afferent arterioles constrict. That reduces blood flow. And so even though blood pressure increases, there's no change in glomerular filtration as a result. All right, so that is what we call the myogenic response. All right, this other one, tubuloglomerular feedback, is also maintained by negative feedback between the afferent arteriole and volume of filtrate that's being produced. So if there is an increased flow of filtrate sensed by the macula densicels, that's part of the juxtaglomerular apparatus, that's in the thick part of the ascending loop of Henle, right, that's going to signal the afferent arterioles to constrict. So if there's high flow through the nephron, that's going to signal the arterioles to constrict, and that's going to reduce the amount of filtrate that's being produced to maintain homeostasis. So we call that tubuloglomerular feedback when that happens. Maybe I can show you a really quick picture of the juxtaglomerular apparatus. Here we go. So here is, right, so here's the descending loop of Henle, here's the ascending loop of Henle, and it passes right between the afferent arteriole and efferent arteriole. And when there's a high flow of filtrate through this portion of the tubule, it's going to cause vasoconstriction of the afferent arteriole. So here we see the juxtaglomerular apparatus right here. So that's going to regulate urine formation as a result. I lost my place. Okay, right here. Okay, let's talk about reabsorption of salt and water. Right, the proximal convoluted tubule returns most molecules that got filtered and water from the filtrate back into the peritubular capillaries. So that's the proximal convoluted tubule. That's the first segment that's coming out of the glomerulus. So don't forget, there's about 180 liters a day of filtrate that's produced. All right, but only 1 to 2 liters of urine is excreted in 24 hours. So what does that say? That says that over 99% of the water that is filtered into Bowman's capsule has to be resorbed back into the blood, or you dehydrate very, very quickly, probably in just a matter of minutes. Right? And that happens in the proximal convoluted tubule. Urine volume, of course, varies according to the needs of the body. If you're drinking a lot, then we don't need to resorb quite as much water. But if you're not staying well hydrated, if you're not drinking, then the kidneys have to work harder to resorb more water. And the kidneys need some water to excrete metabolic wastes. So your kidneys need a minimum of 400 mLs a day to produce urine necessary to excrete metabolic waste, like urea. And so that's the obligatory water loss. So without that amount of water being available, right, the kidneys actually are going to die. They can't perform their function, and those metabolic products are going to build up in your body. All right, so here we see the first step, glomerular filtration, and here we see tubular reabsorption in this part of the nephron. So what do we call this part of the nephron right here? That's the proximal convoluted tubule. So not only is water resorbed, but other important small molecules, like electrolytes. Right? So sodium is resorbed, potassium is resorbed and put back into the blood, and even chloride. Right? And sodium is resorbed due to an active process. Water is resorbed due to a passive process, because it will just follow a concentration gradient that is developed by the sodium gradient. All right, so there is coupled transport between glucose and sodium in the cytoplasm of these tubular cells right here. And you know what? We've looked at this mechanism a number of times. You've already been tested on this diagram maybe once or twice before. All right, so let's take a look at active transport and passive transport, namely facilitated diffusion. So what is the process that is driving all of this? And it has to do, yeah, it's active transport, and it has to do, focus your attention right here, right? I see something that uses ATP. What kind of transport mechanism uses ATP directly? You have to go way back. It seems like yesterday to me, but it might seem like a long time ago for you. What kind of transport mechanism uses ATP? That can move things against the concentration gradient. That is primary active transport, right? Primary active transport. So here is that sodium-potassium pump. And what else can you tell me about the sodium-potassium ATP pump? What about the directions of sodium and potassium? Do they go in the same direction? Opposite directions, right? So you see that this pump is pumping sodium out of the cell, but it is pumping potassium inside. So if sodium is being pumped out of the cell, what's the concentration of sodium inside the cell right here? And that's something that maybe even high school now, you just memorize. What's the concentration of sodium inside the cell compared to outside? It's always going to be low. And that's due to what? This primary active transport mechanism right here. So we got low sodium inside the cells of the proximal convoluted tubule, right? And we have high sodium in the lumen of the kidney tubule because it got filtered out of the blood. So which way does sodium want to go? Does it want to stay in the tubule or does it want to enter the cell? It wants to enter the cell because there's a huge concentration gradient, right? And there's energy in that gradient. Any kind of gradient, there's an energy. All right, so here is another membrane protein that can utilize the flow of sodium into the cell down its concentration gradient and couple it to the movement of glucose, right? So this is a co-transporter. Glucose will go from a low concentration in the kidney tubule to a high concentration inside the cell. But you need energy. Don't you need energy to go from low to high? You sure do. And where is that energy source? It is the sodium gradient, because sodium is just rushing into that cell. When it does, it brings glucose with it, right? So it makes glucose high inside the cell, and it's low outside in this interstitial space right here. So now glucose wants to go from high concentration to low to get into this interstitial space. But remember, glucose can't move across the membrane by itself. It needs a special transporter to do that, right? It doesn't have to be an active process, but it still needs a pathway, some kind of transporter, right? So this is just what we call a facilitated diffusion transporter that lets glucose roll down its concentration gradient from high to low, and then it's picked up by the blood. So that process of glucose going from the filtrate in the lumen of the kidney tubule into the blood, okay, what do we call that process? I forget what I was going to ask. What do we call that process? Going from glucose in the blood to, glucose in the filtrate to glucose in the blood. What do we call that process? Yeah, that's tubular reabsorption. Okay, but that's basically driven by this primary active transporter right here, the sodium-potassium ATP pump. All right, so glucose is actively taken up because you don't want to lose glucose in the urine. All right, so here's filtration in the glomerular corpuscle, the renal corpuscle. Chloride, sodium, sodium is actively transported. And when sodium moves to maintain electrical neutrality, chloride ions move along with it. And as the osmolality changes, water moves, all right, is resorbed. That's just due to osmosis, right? So that's just a passive process, right? Osmosis is a passive process. Okay. All right, so that resorbs a lot of the water, and the proximal convoluted tubule is just doing that to 100% of its ability. Okay, so it doesn't vary the amount of sodium or water that is resorbed due to different changing conditions in the body. It's just working 100% all the time. All right, so 65% of the sodium, chloride, and water is resorbed in the PCT and is returned to the bloodstream. An additional 20% is resorbed in the descending loop of Henle. right? But that still means you're still losing a lot of water because that's only 85% of the water that's filtered are resorbed early in the tubule, right? This is consistent. It's not changed. It's not regulated. But there is a huge energy cost to doing that. 6% of all the calories that you burn during the day are necessary to resorb that sodium and water. So where's that ATP being used? Where's that ATP being used in the kidney? That's almost 10% of your energy just to resorb water in the kidneys. That's a huge amount of energy. Where's that energy being used? Yeah, that sodium potassium ATP pump, right, is used to drive that mechanism. Right, the remaining 15% of, right, so if the 85% is resorbed, that leaves 15%, that's going to be resorbed if necessary in other parts of the nephron, like the distal convoluted tubule and the collecting duct. That resorption can be controlled via some hormone mechanisms that we're going to look at, and that depends on the level of hydration in the body. All right, so let's look at the collecting duct. That plays an important role in water conservation. All right, it's impermeable to salt in the medulla, but it can be regulated when it's close to the cortex. And the permeability of water in the collecting duct depends on the levels of a hormone, namely antidiuretic hormone, or ADH. All right, so what does ADH do? If ADH levels are high, does that produce a lot of urine or no urine whatsoever? Okay, antidiuretic. It's going to reduce urine production, right? And so you're going to retain fluids in the body as a result. Okay. And that happens in the collecting duct. So homeostasis of plasma concentration can be maintained by antidiuretic hormone, making fine adjustments of water resorption. All right, so don't forget, ADH has got another name. What's another name for ADH? Okay, you should definitely write this down because I don't know if your book does a big, even probably mentions it a couple times, but they don't make a big deal of it. But there's another name for ADH. It's called vasopressin. So if you hear that term or see that term, vasopressin, just convert it right away into ADH. All right, that's the term that I really like to use, ADH. And where does ADH come from? The posterior pituitary in response to dehydration. So when you're dehydrated, ADH is secreted, and that reduces urine production. That helps you retain fluids. The way that it does that is that it stimulates the insertion of special water channels in the membranes of cells, and those water channels we call aquaporins, or pores for water to move. So remember, water can't move through the plasma membrane. Why can't water just move through the plasma membrane by itself? What's the essential, simple nature of a plasma membrane? It's a phospholipid bilayer, so it's mostly lipid, which is what? Hydrophobic. And water is what? The quintessential hydrophilic molecule. It's highly polar, right? It can't get through that plasma membrane by itself unless there are pores in the cell membrane, and those are what we call aquaporins in the collecting duct. All right. So when ADH is high, water is drawn out of the collecting duct by the high osmolality of interstitial fluid. Water just flows down a concentration gradient and resorbed by the juxtamedullary nephrons. There are capillaries around the loops of Henle and the juxtamedullary nephrons that we call they're special peritubular capillaries that we call the vasorecta, right, around those juxtamedullary nephrons. All right, so let's look at a nice response loop right here. If there's low water intake, that produces dehydration, which means plasma osmolality, or the saltiness of plasma, increases. There are receptors that can monitor that. There are osmoreceptors in the hypothalamus. Right, and then the hypothalamus can control the posterior pituitary. There's a tract that goes from the hypothalamus down to the posterior pituitary, and those, when there's an action potential reaching the axon terminus in the posterior pituitary, then those axons are going to release something that kind of looks like a neurotransmitter, but it's picked up by the blood, so it's really acting like a hormone, and that's called antidiuretic hormone. So now it's in the blood, and it goes to the kidneys, and it inserts aquaporins into the kidney tubules, and so water can move from the filtrate back into the plasma. So that increases water reabsorption. And as a result, there's less water excreted in the urine. And how does that correspond to the initial stimulus? It subtracts from the initial stimulus, so this is a nice negative feedback mechanism maintaining water balance. All right, and the opposite is true as well. If the initial stimulus is overhydration, the blood becomes very dilute, right? The solutes become very dilute, decreased plasma osmolality. That is monitored by the hypothalamus. The hypothalamus has a set point and makes a decision on what to do, and it tells the posterior pituitary to stop secreting antidiuretic hormone. And that signal tells the kidney to decrease water reabsorption by getting rid of these aquaporins in the membrane, so more water is lost in the urine because it can't be resorbed. And again, that's a nice negative feedback mechanism. So here is a nice exam figure that's not in your book. All right, so I do want to go over this. All right, this is probably, you guys are familiar with this. So we're just going to look at this diagram. What's another name for vasopressin? ADH. And I see it's in the blood. Ah, how did it get there? How did it get in the blood? How did ADH get in the blood? Where did it come from? The posterior pituitary, and the posterior pituitary put it in the blood because the hypothalamus told it to, right? Okay. And so we have vasopressin in the blood, and it is a hydrophilic compound, right? So what does that mean? Can vasopressin enter this cell of a kidney tubule right here if it's hydrophilic? Can it get across, can a hydrophilic molecule get across the membrane? No, it can't. It's trapped on the outside of the cell. So what has to be on the outside of this kidney tubule cell in order for it to affect this cell right here? Vasopressin can diffuse out of the blood into this interstitial space, but there has to be a receptor on the plasma membrane. So here is an ADH receptor, right? And it translocates the signal via a cyclic AMP second messenger. So ADH binds to this receptor, ATP is converted into cyclic AMP. This second messenger system then can act on metabolism inside the cell to take these endosomes, and these endosomes have the aquaporin transporters or aquaporin pores that can't work because they're inside the cell, and because of a number of steps of amplification and phosphatases being activated, changing different enzymes, these endosomes are brought over to this apical surface of the cell membrane of this cell. And, you know, this is just a phospholipid bilayer. Here we have a phospholipid bilayer. So these endosomes fuse with the apical surface right here. And when it does, it carries these aquaporins and they're inserted into the plasma membrane. And when those pores are there, look what can happen to water. Water can go down its concentration gradient. All right, so here is a high water concentration that's only 300 milliosmolar. Right, and water is less concentrated here because look at the osmolality. It's double, so water diffuses into the cell and eventually into the blood because the blood right here in this part of the vasa recta, the osmolality is 700 milliosmolar. So water moves down its concentration gradient from the filtrate into blood. What do we call that process when you go from filtrate to blood? That's tubular reabsorption. And that's due to the insertion of these aquaporins in the cell membrane due to this ADH signal. Okay, so who's got a question on this slide right here? Maybe you've looked at it before lecture. I kind of hope so. All right, so this isn't in your book, but you do have the key for this particular figure in your exam study guide. All right, so what are the steps for increasing water resorption as due to this, what, antidiuretic hormone? So as water is reabsorbed, is that acting like, what is the influence here? Is that a diuretic or an antidiuretic when water is resorbed? It's an antidiuretic because it's taking it out of the filtrate. It will take it out of urine, right? So that will make a very concentrated kind of urine. So you got ADH binding to the membrane receptor. The receptor activates cyclic AMP as a second messenger, right? That activates a number of enzymes inside the cell that take these endosomes with aquaporin channels in them, and that inserts it into the plasma membrane, and then water can move down its concentration gradient back into the blood. So that's really nice water reabsorption, right? Making small amounts of concentrated urine when that happens. Okay. All right, let's talk about renal plasma clearance. Some of these things you're familiar with already. Here we see Bowman's capsule, and filtration produces filtrate, and basically that's just what? That's just plasma, right, that's going through the holes in the glomerulus, right? And that filtrate then moves through the various tubular systems in the nephron. And the other processes besides filtration, you have tubular resorption and tubular secretion. All right, so these three processes determine what's going to be excreted in the body. All right, so excretion is going to be due to things that put things in the filtrate minus the things that are resorbed. All right, so filtration plus secretion minus reabsorption determine what the excretion is. All right, so excretion, let's see what I have right here. Filtration plus secretion minus resorption determine what excretion is. So that's a pretty simple algebraic equation right there. All right, so not all the blood delivered to the glomerulus is filtered into glomerular capsule. Well, that's a good thing, right? Because then blood would just plug up the glomerulus. You still need some fluid to leave via the efferent arteriole. Right, 20% is filtered. The remainder passes into the efferent arteriole and back into the circulation. But substances that are left in that 80% that doesn't get filtered still can be cleared by active transport. So if there is urea in the blood, right, in the glomerulus, 20% can be lost, but 80% gets passed to the efferent arteriole. There probably should be a nice way to get rid of that excess urea and other compounds, maybe excess sodium or hydrogen ions, and to put them into the kidney tubules, right, to clear them from your body. And that's done by active transport. We call that tubular secretion. Okay. I think we talked about glucose already, but let's just recapitulate glucose, because that's so important. All right, so glucose is a small molecule, and even some amino acids, if they're small enough, are normally resorbed from the filtrate. And this occurs in the proximal convoluted tubule by carrier-mediated co-transport with sodium. And I showed you that slide already. All right, but because it requires that membrane transporter, that means if there is too much glucose in the filtrate, that will saturate the transporters. And if the transporters are all saturated, then glucose won't be completely resorbed from the filtrate and will end up in urine and excreted from your body. All right, so that level is what we call the transport maximum, or TM. All right, under normal conditions, nobody should ever have glucose or amino acids in the blood, right? But if there are conditions like diabetes mellitus, you will have glucose in the blood, because when somebody has diabetes mellitus, their glucose goes way above 200 milligrams per 100 mLs of plasma. And that's what we call the renal threshold for saturating those transporters. Okay, and if your blood exceeds this renal threshold right here, we call that hyperglycemia. And when hyperglycemia results in glucose in the blood, then that's a nice sign for diabetes mellitus. All right, so the kidneys also regulate levels of sodium and potassium, acid, bicarbonate, chloride, phosphorus, by matching excretion to ingestion or your diet. And control of plasma sodium is important in regulation of blood volume. And when you regulate blood volume, what do you regulate? Blood pressure, right? And so this is a long-term mechanism. So controlling sodium concentration in your body is just a way that you can control blood pressure on a day-to-day or week-to-week or even month-to-month kind of process. This is long-term regulation of blood pressure. What does your body use for short-term regulation of blood pressure? I think that was maybe on the last... No, that might be on this test, too. That's called the baroreceptor reflex, right? The baroreceptor reflex. But when your body adjusts blood pressure by regulating sodium concentration, right? We talked about that mechanism before. What mechanism adjusts long-term regulation of blood pressure? It requires hormones. The renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. So that's sort of what we're going to talk about now. And the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism not only regulates sodium, but it helps regulate potassium. And potassium is important for proper function of what? Skeletal and cardiac muscles, because of its effect on the resting membrane potential, right? And repolarization and hyperpolarization. So both of these are important because of the resting membrane potential and action potentials, which you're really familiar with. All right, so 90% of the sodium and potassium that's filtered, where does that get filtered? Where does anything get filtered? Renal corpuscle, right? Filtered means going from the glomerulus into Bowman's capsule, right? 90% is resorbed before it gets to the distal convoluted tubule, namely what? The proximal convoluted tubule and the loop of Henle. But, okay, 10% can be adjusted, right, in the distal convoluted tubule. And the mechanism there is going to be controlled by aldosterone. And it's going to be adjusted depending on the body's needs. All right, so aldosterone controls potassium secretion and sodium reabsorption. So what can you tell me about sodium and potassium and the effects of sodium? Are they in the same direction or opposite directions? Opposite directions. So if you forget this mechanism, if you ever see it on a board exam, say, what's the mechanism of aldosterone? And one question and one answer says it increases resorption of sodium and potassium. Could that be the right answer? No, because why? It's not opposite, right? And what about if it says it increases the secretion of sodium and potassium? You're going to say no, because it's not opposite. Why do you think it's going to be opposite? There's a key from way back when, and we looked at it on a diagram already today. And it requires 6% of the energy in your body all the time. It's a sodium-potassium ATP pump. And how does that work? Does it pump sodium and potassium in the same direction or opposite directions? Opposite directions. And because of that sodium-potassium ATP pump, aldosterone has to utilize that mechanism, right? Aldosterone can't make sodium and potassium go in the same direction because of that sodium-potassium ATP pump. All right, so aldosterone regulates potassium secretion and sodium reabsorption. Right, in the absence of aldosterone, 80% of the remaining sodium is resorbed into the distal convoluted tubule and cortical collecting duct. When aldosterone is high, the remaining sodium is resorbed. All right, so here we have the whole nephron right here. Normally, right, all the potassium is resorbed, right, in the proximal convoluted tubule. And if you have excess potassium in your body, then it's going to be secreted in the distal convoluted tubule, right? So it can make up for too much potassium in your body. So we're going to see how that happens. All right, so that's due to the juxtaglomerular apparatus. Here you see the renal corpuscle, efferent arteriole, and the loop of Henle and the distal convoluted tubule pass right through between these arterioles right here. So this is what we call the juxtaglomerular apparatus. There are smooth muscle cells that can constrict, reduce blood flow to the glomerulus. There are some granular cells that form in this interstitial space right here. And then there are some special cells in the loop of Henle that we call the macula densa cells. So these granular cells and macula densa cells make up the juxtaglomerular apparatus. that's going to have an effect on sodium and potassium and blood pressure. All right, so the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system is activated by the release of renin. Okay, and renin comes from the granular cells within the afferent arteriole. So here are these granular cells that can release renin. Right, and what does renin do? It converts angiotensinogen. And what can you tell me about angiotensinogen? Inactive, it's in your blood all the time, waiting to go to work. And what converts it into a working form is renin from the granular cells of the juxtaglomerular apparatus. So angiotensinogen is converted to angiotensin 1. All right, and then angiotensin 1 is not really active. It's converted into an active form called angiotensin 2 by angiotensin converting enzyme. You might have to go back and look at that previous exam figure that you have, but you had to know this down pat for the last exam, I believe. Okay. Or is it in, oh, this exam? Oh, it's the first cardiac, it's the second cardiac chapter, cardiac output. Okay. All right, and that's in the lungs. All right, then angiotensin 2 stimulates the release of aldosterone. Where does that aldosterone come from? That's from the adrenal cortex, right? So angiotensin 2 causes the release of aldosterone. All right, so inadequate intake of sodium chloride or salt causes a decrease in blood volume, right? Because that lower osmolality inhibits ADH, causing less water reabsorption. That low blood volume and renal blood flow stimulate renin release. So the juxtaglomerular apparatus, right, is stimulated by low blood volume, right? And via the direct effects of blood pressure on the granular cells, right, and sympathetic activity, these cells are going to release renin as a result, right, which is going to eventually produce what? When renin is released, what happens to aldosterone? Right, they're directly related to each other. So renin produces aldosterone. So let's look at this feedback mechanism right here, a nice response loop. Let's start with what? You always start with a stimulus, and let's just say low sodium intake. All right, so if your sodium intake is low, that's going to have a tendency to lower plasma sodium concentration. And the hypothalamus can sense that. There are osmoreceptors in the hypothalamus, and that's going to send signals to the posterior pituitary to decrease, right, antidiuretic hormone. And as a result, decreased water reabsorption in the collecting ducts will take place. And that's going to, right, if the aquaporins are taken out of the membrane, that's going to increase urine volume, which will decrease blood volume, so your blood pressure is going to decrease. But there are things in your body that will measure that decrease in blood volume as a result of low sodium intake. Okay, so that means the hypothalamus will then stimulate the sympathetic nervous system. But the kidney can also measure low blood volume, and that's because of the juxtaglomerular apparatus. Right? The sympathetic nervous system is also going to directly stimulate the juxtaglomerular apparatus, causing an increased secretion of renin. Right? So then renin does its usual thing, increases, it converts angiotensinogen into angiotensin 2, right? And through a couple steps, angiotensin 2 is going to go to the adrenal cortex to increase the release of aldosterone. And aldosterone is going to increase sodium reabsorption in the collecting duct. And as you increase sodium, all right, then sodium concentration in the blood is going to increase. And how does this response compare to the initial stimulus? It subtracts from it, so this is a nice negative feedback loop that works between antidiuretic hormone and aldosterone. All right, so one thing you might notice, okay, when there's low sodium intake, right, what happens to blood volume right here? Low sodium intake, you have low blood volume. And without these other compensating mechanisms, when blood volume decreases, what's going to happen to blood pressure? if there's some way we can subtract out the effects of the sympathetic nervous system and the kidney to compensate for low sodium right here, or this low blood volume, what's going to happen to blood pressure as blood volume goes down? Low blood volume means less blood flowing back to the heart. So the heart has a smaller end diastolic volume. It's not quite as stretched anymore. What happens to contractility of the heart? It decreases, right? So when cardiac output goes down, what happens to blood pressure? It decreases, right? So this right here, I point this out to you because that's a very important way that somebody who has hypertension or high blood pressure can help maintain, help lower their blood pressure just by looking at what? Just by controlling their dietary intake of sodium. So that's always the first thing somebody with hypertension should do. Just decrease their sodium intake, regulate it because it's going to help reduce their blood pressure. And if they can't do it by diet alone, then we need to start interacting with some of these other feedback mechanisms, right? By maybe giving a diuretic or by giving alpha-2 stimulants that will vasodilate or somehow adjust the sympathetic nervous system, or by ACE inhibitors, right? By manipulating the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism. But the first thing that somebody should always try is what? Just watching their sodium intake for helping reduce their blood pressure. All right. Well, this slide right here just didn't show very well what the effect of aldosterone is on the kidney. So here is the second figure that's not in your textbook that shows the mechanism of action for aldosterone. And you're familiar with all these pieces already. So this kind of ties in everything that you've learned in the class. All right, so here we have aldosterone in the blood. And what kind of hormone? And so that's a hormone, right? It's being transported by the blood. And what kind of compound is aldosterone? Is it a protein or is it a sugar? It's a steroid. And what kind of compound is a steroid? It's a lipid, so that means it's hydrophobic. It's a hydrophobic compound. And so what does that mean in terms of diffusing through the plasma membrane of this collecting duct cell right here? Since it's hydrophobic, that means it can pass right through the cell membrane. So there doesn't have to be a surface receptor on the cell membrane because it can enter the cell directly. And there are cytoplasmic receptors for aldosterone. So aldosterone binds to these cytoplasmic receptors, which then move into the nucleus, and these act as transcription factors. What the heck is transcription? It says right here, transcription. What is transcription? Tell me something about transcription. That's the first step in protein synthesis, right? So these transcription factors activate the genome to produce messenger RNAs, right? And messenger RNAs are necessary for the second step of protein synthesis, which is called? You got transcription and then? Translation. So these messengers leave the nucleus, end up in the cytoplasm, right? And they combine with the apparatus for making proteins like ribosomes and things like that. So translation takes place, and that produces proteins. These proteins, right, there could be a number of different kinds of proteins. They could be new channels that we see right here. And this would be a sodium channel, right? And it's a gated channel. The new proteins could be new pumps, ATP pumps, for sodium and potassium. Right, these proteins could also modulate the existing channels that are in the plasma membrane. Right, so that translation has a number of effects in the body. Right, it increases the ATP pumps and the effectiveness of these channels in the membrane, plus also the number of channels in the cell membrane that communicate with the lumen of the distal tubule and collecting ducts. Okay. So, as these channels are put in the membrane, where is potassium at a high concentration? Inside the cell or outside the cell? It's inside the cell. And as you put a potassium channel inside the cell membrane, potassium is going to go from high concentration to low. So it's going to go from the cell into the filtrate right here, and we call that secretion, tubular secretion, as a result of what kind of signal? Aldosterone. Right? So aldosterone, if you look at this figure right here, aldosterone promotes the secretion of potassium into the filtrate. And if it's in the filtrate, where is it going to end up? In the urine and excreted from your body. All right, now what about sodium? How is sodium? Is sodium high inside the cell or low? It's low inside the cell. It's high in the filtrate, and as you put sodium channels or pores into the duct right here, sodium is going to move down its concentration gradient. And it's going to, if you go from filtrate back into the body, we call that reabsorption. And that's controlled by what hormone? Aldosterone, right? In the distal tubules of the kidney. All right, so what maintains high potassium inside the cell and low sodium? It's got to be this sodium-potassium ATP pump right here, right? So that's the essential reason why aldosterone has opposite effects, right? That's the reason why aldosterone causes potassium secretion but sodium resorption because of the sodium-potassium ATP pump. All right, so that just increases the diffusion of potassium from the blood into the filtrate and the diffusion of sodium from the filtrate back into the blood, all because of this sodium-potassium ATP pump right here. All right, so some other things that you should be able to compare and contrast with these two figures, with ADH and aldosterone, is which one has a cytoplasmic receptor? Aldosterone, because it's a steroid. And ADH has a plasma membrane receptor because it is hydrophilic. Okay, so these diagrams show all of those effects. All right, so this is a particularly important exam figure, as well as the ADH one is important, is nice and important too, because it reinforces that endosome and how endosomes can be used to regulate metabolism or physiology in the cell very rapidly. Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, so we were talking about ADH and aldosterone, two hormones. What's another name for ADH? Vasopressin. All right, and then we got aldosterone. And what kinds of hormones are they? What's their, what is their nature? ADH is hydrophilic. All right, aldosterone is a steroid, which means that it's a lipid, so it's hydrophobic. And if it's hydrophobic, can it pass through the cell membrane? Absolutely. It can go right into the cytoplasm. And if it's going to have an effect on the cell, what does that cell have to have? It's got to have a receptor. And that receptor is a cytoplasmic receptor, right? Cytoplasmic receptor. All right, and when it binds to that receptor, it acts as a transcription factor, which produces proteins, new proteins inside the cell. Transcription factor. So I'm actually writing more stuff than you asked for on the board, but that's okay. Okay, we'll finish it off really quick, all right? Transcription factor means that it produces what? New proteins. And those proteins could be pores or channels. It could be regulatory molecules for regulation of those pores. And it produces more pumps. And in particular, what kind of pumps? The sodium-potassium ATP pump. Okay. ADH, on the other hand, since it's hydrophilic, has to bind to a membrane. Well, what, in order for ADH to have any effect on the cell, what does that cell have to have? A receptor. And ADH can't get in the cell, so where does the receptor have to be? On the plasma membrane. All right, so we got membrane, receptor, Okay, and that membrane receptor acts through a second messenger system. Namely, what kind of second messenger? The cyclic AMP. Second messenger, and then endosomes, which carry what? What do these endosomes carry? What's stored in those endosomes? The aquaporins. All right, so endosomes, cyclic AMP causes those endosomes, which contain aquaporins. It puts them into the plasma membrane. So those aquaporins become active, and then water can move from the filtrate back into the blood. And when water moves from filtrate to blood, what happens to urine production? Does it go up or down? Urine production goes down. Is that a diuretic effect or an antidiuretic effect when urine goes down? And so that's why they call that antidiuretic hormone. Okay, so that's pretty good stuff. What else do I want to talk about today? Well, I guess maybe I'll just, we talked about atrial natriuretic hormone or peptide once before. And don't forget, that's produced by the atria due to stretching of the atria. When there's too much blood volume, the heart stretches. All right, so this has the opposite effect of antidiuretic hormone and aldosterone, so it's antagonistic to aldosterone. When your blood volume is too high, it stretches your heart, that stimulates salt and water excretion. All right, so atrial natriuretic hormone acts as an endogenous diuretic. It's opposite to the effect of antidiuretic hormone. And so I think that's all I'm going to talk about. But I'll be happy to answer some questions. Ah, look at this. We have a little green note right here. Is that a little green note? Is that green? That's SI. All right, and so I'd like to thank our SI leader. Oh, she had to leave early. Helen, so anyway, I guess we could clap her anyway. Clap for her, maybe it will get back to her that we thank her anyway. So we should always thank our SI leaders. Did anybody go to SI this semester? A couple people? That's nice. Did anybody find it helpful? Yeah? Good. Okay. Of course. Good. Well, I just want to share that. And so if you have any friends taking physiology next semester, would you recommend they go to SI? Was that helpful for passing the class? Definitely. So it's definitely a positive. All right, so that's it for today, except for the sign-in sheet. Is there a sign-in sheet around anywhere? It's over there. If somebody needs it, so don't forget about the final a week from today. No lecture on Thursday because it's finals week, and I don't think we could have lecture. I think I'm prohibited from having lecture. Yeah. Finals at 10:30. For 2 hours, but it's just a regular test. Okay, who wants a suggestion on what to study? End of chapter questions. Internet questions. Exam figures. Lecture notes. Just like all the other tests. Okay? So, yeah.
This will be on the 15th, right? The exam? The 15th is the final, right?
The final? Yeah, that's on the 15th. Yeah, it's on the 15th.